Welcome, it's John Cummings. Going to do a wee talk tonight in the Not So Great War, 1914-18. So I'll leave it now for John to open up.
Well, at first I was going to call this World War One again. We seem to be calling it the Not So Great War, but either way, I'm just going to say more or less the same thing anyway, because I think, as far as the working class was concerned, the World War was a pretty rotten event. Max Hastings, in a recent documentary, as I mentioned in the synopsis, argued that the war was tragic but necessary in a programme called The Necessary War a few months ago. He started off by saying no one nation deserves all the blame, but there's a but coming. You can always expect that from the likes of him. He says, but there's an overriding case that German recklessness contributed more than anything else to cause the July crisis to escalate into a European war and then further into a world war. He says that the German violation of Belgian neutrality was an excellent reason for going to war, but the context in which he says that is quite interesting. He's discussing it with another historian who he brings on to try to back up his arguments. And both of them, in the course of the discussion about this being an excellent reason for going to war, make it clear it's an excellent reason in the sense, an excellent reason to give to the public, in the sense of preparing the public for going to war. So it's quite clear within their own programme that that's the sense in which they mean reason. They don't mean reason in a well-reasoned argument. They mean reason as pretext, as someone asks you, why are you doing this? This is the reason, but it may not add up, and of course in this case we would argue that it doesn't. Neil Ferguson, in another documentary, he argues a different point of view. He argues that Britain's decision to enter the conflict was a catastrophic error, but not in the same way that we would say it's a catastrophic error. It's a catastrophic error from the interests of the British capitalist class, and ultimately his argument really is that Britain could have stayed out of it, and that Britain bears a major part of the responsibility for turning what was essentially a Balkan crisis arising out of some state-sponsored terrorism, the assassination at Sarajevo, and Britain allowed that to escalate into a European war due to all the labyrinthine treaties and so on that they were involved in. So that's essentially his argument. He does bring on quite a lot of interesting facts about the conduct of the war, most of which were quite well known. He argues about why the war continues, which is not a thing that the programme was really meant to be dealing with. It was meant to be dealing with the causes of war. But nonetheless, he argues that, seems to be arguing that that's part of the cause of the continuation of the war. Once people have had experience of it, it releases all the familiar argument that you've heard before about human nature. It releases all the things that are bad in humanity. The fact they've been at war, they start to become embittered and they want to continue. Now, to what extent that may be true among some, we wouldn't particularly care to argue, because what we are concerned about are the underlying causes of the war. And although there are all these intrigues and diplomatic schemes going on, you have to ask yourself, well, why was one country lining up with another against another group? Why was that happening? What was that all about? And of course, we know the answer to that. So both argued from the perspective of British interests, that is the interests of the British capitalist class. So when I say Britain, of course, you know that I'm talking about the British capitalist class. And if I refer to the British, that's who we mean. Both followed the conventional narrative. It was the assassination of the Archduke Ferdinand in Sarajevo, I think on the 28th of June. Him and his wife were assassinated there, and that led to, because of the labyrinth of treaties, alliances and diplomatic intrigue, it eventually led to the outbreak of the war. And it's quite interesting to note, at the time, at the start of the war, just before war was declared, on August the 3rd, I've got a quote here from Queen Mary, of all people, George V's wife, his consort, and quite a short quote, but it's quite interesting. What she says is, for such a stupid reason too. But to have to go to war on account of tiresome Serbia beggars belief. And we would be inclined to agree with that. In fact, we'd very much agree with that. It does beggar belief. And in fact, we've said that on many occasions. And so incidentally, does the pretext that they used, oh, well, that's it now. You've violated poor little Belgium. Would this be the same little Belgium whose king of... or whose late king at that time, I think, had his own personal colonies in which people were enslaved, native people were enslaved in the Congo. Yes, that would be the same Belgium. That started out as a rhetorical question, by the way, but I think we socialists tend to answer rhetorical questions just for the avoidance of any doubt. So, Queen Mary says it beggars belief, and yes, we would be inclined to agree. Tiresome Serbia and tiresome Belgium. These are not the causes of the war. These are part of a labyrinth, as I've said already, of treaties and alliances and so on. And the Socialist Standard, I couldn't find the article concerned, but there's an article published, I think, just shortly after the outbreak of war, and it pointed out some of the secret promises that had been made between certain members of the British Cabinet and the French government. And the Standard went into it in a great deal of detail because it was presumably something people were talking about at the time, Sir Edward Grey and members of the French government. So there was plans, partly due to French interests. French had an interest in capturing back Alsace-Lorraine, and it's been argued by some historians that France and Russia were the only real powers that actually would have benefited from a war or at the time saw war as something that would further their interests. It's an interesting argument, but again, it smacks a bit of the blame sort of culture that Max Hastings is using in his case about Germany. Another historian's case, well, France was really behind it. So again, what you have to look at is the dynamic of the whole situation, why it was that they had all these treaties, what drove them to do it. Max Hastings, on using the Belgian pretext, I've referred to it already, he says, this is the thing in a wee bit more detail, he says, Belgium provided a tipping point. All sorts of British people who cared nothing for Serbia or Russia could easily get their minds around the notion that it was outrageous that the most powerful army in Europe proposed to crush beneath its boots a small state simply to serve the convenience of the Schlieffen Plan. And wasn't that indeed a decent and honourable reason for Britain to go to war? This is the sort of nonsense that Hastings comes out with. Now, in the other programme I referred to, Neil Ferguson's programme, he pointed out something that already knew, but possibly a lot of other people didn't know, and that is that the German army was actually smaller than the French army in the outbreak of war, and the Entente powers actually outnumbered the Central powers by something like almost 3-1. So contrary to the idea that Germany was so militaristic and all of that, the facts don't bear that out. Also, it wasn't really in German interests to have a war in Europe. Not that necessarily means that they didn't, by certain acts, contribute towards the whole process of going to war, as we'll see. So some of that myth about the German militarism, that's perpetrated again. Of course, the German government didn't do itself any favours, because then once it got into all these entanglements and it saw that it did after all want a place in the sun, They got into such a mess that eventually that their own statements could be used against them to illustrate the point that they were militaristic. But in actual fact, although Prussia did have a sort of militaristic tradition, the new Germany itself wasn't even in its interest to do that. What they wanted to do was two contradictory things. From Bismarck's time onwards, what they wanted to do was let the new Germany develop in terms of industrial side economically and politically, but at the same time what Bismarck wanted to do was to keep the old the old values, the old conservative values. So they wanted basically a section of the aristocracy to still dominate. Now that was contradictory, because the forces unleashed by the development of capitalism was going to make that an impossible thing. But that's what he was trying to do. And later on, the Kaiser and his ministers, once Bismarck was dismissed, the Kaiser was much more inept at following these kind of policies, and got themselves into a bit of a mess, got themselves involved in all sorts of treaties and alliances and so forth. But again, the detail of that is not as important as why it was that they had to have alliances in the first place. On the outbreak of war, here's what Sir Edward Grey said in the House of Commons, and you get a wee hint here of the real reasons coming out. Sir Edward Grey, but just a hint, Sir Edward Grey advised the House of Commons on the 3rd of August, just before the declaration of war in Germany, that if Britain did not intervene, and this is a direct quote what he said, we should sacrifice our respect and good name and reputation before the world, and should not escape the most serious and grave economic consequences. You notice that it's a convention amongst these people to leave the thing that's really important to the last, as if that's just an afterthought. You know, it's this honour and all of this that we're really concerned about. Poor little Belgium and such like. But it's the economic questions that are far more important. And a person on, another historian, just another wee quote, short one. This is from a book called The German Wars, by a guy called Professor Goodspeed. He was in the Canadian Armed Forces, a professor in Ontario, Canada. And he says, yet the Sarajevo murders by themselves were surely too small an event to bear full responsibility for the gigantic upheavals that shook the world. Men in general, and not merely historians, have an instinctive feeling that causes should in some way be commensurate with results. Well, I don't know about an instinctive feeling, but certainly what he says there is pretty true to life. You know, usually gigantuan events such as world wars, even continental wars, are not due to some assassination, just one thing such as that. After all, there have been many assassinations in the past. Although you could go into the whole Balkan business and see a tangle of events there, which you could spend the rest of tonight and several nights talking about. So all of these things came to bear on one another. But again, it doesn't really get to what is the root of the matter. So the utterances of Queen Mary and Sir Edward Grey on the 3rd of August seem to indicate that the ruling class hadn't quite got its story straight yet about the war, which is often what happens, as we've seen in recent wars. They start off with one idea, one justification, and then in the course of the war they start adding other reasons. Well, after all, we had to get rid of some awful tyrant such as Saddam Hussein, and then they add all sorts of other things as the war progresses, and the First World War was no exception. For some, it was presented as the war to end all wars, and, well, that sounds pretty awful, just thinking about that 100 years later. But 3 weeks later, on 25th of August, a statement was issued which did shed some light on the recent events. And that was a statement published by the Executive Committee of the Socialist Party in the Socialist Standard, of course. And it was the war and the socialist position that said, whereas the capitalists of Europe have quarrelled over trade routes in the world's markets and are endeavouring to induce the workers into their masters' quarrel, and whereas the Labour so-called leaders of this country, in common with their fellows in the continent, are actually assisting the master class in using the thieves' quarrel to confuse the workers and turn their attention away from the class struggle. And then from there it went on to reiterate the class basis of capitalism and the class war arising from it, how the coercive power of the state machine was being used to further the interests of the capitalist class, whose state it was after all, and of course went on further, as you'll all be familiar with, to declare that there was no interest at stake that justified the shedding of a single drop of working class blood, and that As we had no quarrel with the workers of any country, we extended our goodwill towards them, pledged ourselves to work for the overthrow of capitalism and the triumph of socialism. So we made it quite clear, within 3 weeks of the outbreak of the war, that statement was issued. The EC didn't have to think particularly hard, oh, what will our attitude be? It was quite easy. The socialist position was quite clear. We knew from our declaration of principles why the state machine existed and how and in what circumstances it would be set in motion. It would be set in motion to defend the interests of the capitalist class whom it represents, whether that be against internal enemies or external enemies. And of course, that's what happened. So it's a very good statement. And of course, it's been used again. You can use it for any war, essentially, because it makes the essential socialist position quite clear. So we've made our position clear on what the war was about. But what was it that the great powers wanted? Well, Britain wanted to safeguard the empire, of course, and its trade that was associated with it, and maintain its, what at that time was called, its splendid isolation. It also wanted, as far as Europe was concerned, to maintain the balance of power. That's tended to be for quite some time, a few centuries in fact, Britain's idea about what to do about Europe. Keep them busy amongst themselves, make sure no one power dominates Europe, and that leaves us free to dominate the rest of the world, which by that time they had more or less captured, or at least all the good bits. Russia, it had ambitions in the Balkans, and this is where Serbia comes in. It wanted the Dardanelles and Constantinople. But of course that could lead to conflict with Austria, whose heterogeneous empire would be threatened by the Pan-Slavism and unleashed by Russian victories in that part of the Mediterranean. Serbian nationalists themselves, they hoped to do what Italy and Germany had done in recent memory, because bear in mind this is a century ago, and to people around then it was in relatively recent memory that Italy had become a nation state, as had Germany. So they wanted to create a greater Serbia out of the Balkans. Russia, of course, hoped with the Trans-Siberian Railroad to open up a vast new market in China, and that would be a threat to British interests there, because they would be trying to capture a lot of the British trade in the Far East, which moved through the Suez Canal. Russia also wanted access to the Mediterranean, which was British, although probably most seas and oceans at that time would be British. If you tried to do anything anywhere, usually the British would turn up telling you, well, no, you'll have to come to an arrangement with us on these matters. Germany, as I've said already, they since Bismarck's time, they wanted to maintain peace in Europe to give Germany, the new German Empire, a chance to develop. But at the same time, they had this contradictory notion of wanting to preserve monarchical and a conservative type of government. And it wasn't the constitutional monarchies of other countries, such as Britain, where, you know, nobody paid any attention to what the King of England thought, unless it suited them. You know, if they wanted to sort of bring him out as their mascot, then they might quote a thing or two that George V might have said, but he didn't really have much to say anyway, to be honest. So Bismarck's successors and the Kaiser, they adhered to the same aims that Bismarck had done, but they tended to be less astute. They wanted peace in Europe, just like the British, because war might lead to domination of Europe by one great power. In Germany's case, they had the fear that France would tend to dominate Europe again, and they didn't quite like the idea of that. But German industrial and economic power had grown greatly since 1871, and Germany, due to all the interests of the other countries, that all this labyrinth I'm talking about of conflicting interests, Germany's central position in Europe made it liable to attack. It felt landlocked, and the German case was that they were surrounded by hostile powers, hostile alliances. And if you look on a map at the position of, or just think of where Russia is, where France is, and then Britain joins in with those two, or apparently to Germans, because Britain apparently never made any promise on paper. So it looks to the German government as though they're being encircled. And it doesn't look that way. That's what it is. But then on the other hand, from the British point of view, Germans, the development of Germany, because they now want a place in the sun, that is threatening the British interest, which is already established. And this is what Max Hastings thinks that the German government should have just meekly accepted. Well, that's Britain's territory, and it shouldn't encroach upon that, which you can't expect that to happen. It's never happened before in history, and it's not going to happen anytime soon. So, from the mid-1890s, the German government had used its economic power to devote significant economic resources to building up the Kaiserliche Marine, the Imperial German Navy. And, of course, that becomes a rival to the British Royal Navy for world supremacy. So, it goes on and on about competing with each other. It never, ever got to the stage where the German state managed to, with its navy, seriously compete with the British. But the propaganda put out at the time was that, you know, once one nation begins to compete with another, then they both put out propaganda, and it serves the interests of those who want to build up more forces to suggest that there is a more serious threat than there might actually be. There was one quote, which I've got somewhere here, but I'll not look for it, I'll just try and remember it. And it was basically something to the effect that Churchill had quoted, I think in the House of Commons perhaps, somewhere or other, he said that the economists had said, they had wanted six dreadnoughts, the economists had said four, and Churchill said, so we compromised on eight. And that's the kind of state that they were in at the time, where you know, you could do no wrong if you were going to build more machinery for warfare. So they knew this war was coming, and certainly from the early part of the 20th century onwards, although it had been known it was coming probably for the last 40 years, towards, you know, at the beginning of the 20th century, up until the outbreak of war, it became more and more apparent that the powers that were going to be facing each other was going to be Britain and Germany. Now, that had gone from being not so certain, in fact, not so obvious even, a few decades ago, when the main rival was Russia, and Britain was more concerned about Russia threatening them in the Far East. But then when Russia was defeated by Japan, with the help of Britain, with the special Anglo-Japanese treaty, which we've not got time to go into, but that's quite interesting as well. But that helped to keep Russia at bay out in the Far East, because the British were always concerned that Russia might invade India, and of course that was a jewel in the crown, and you can't have that, just like any of the other British possessions, you can't really have that. So as I say, the arms race between Britain and Germany eventually extended to the rest of Europe, because they've all got competing interests as well. None of them can afford to be left behind. So all the major powers are developing their industries to produce the equipment and weapons necessary for European conflict. And it turns out, of course, it's a world conflict, because there's all sorts of battles going on in Africa as well in that war. So between 1908 and 1913, the military spending of the European powers increased by 50%. And if you look further back, there's plenty of other statistics that you can quote, but I think we're quite familiar with them. So, unfortunately, the situation we're in today, 100 years to the month after the outbreak of that awful slaughter, is that wars raging in Syria, Israel, Ukraine, Iraq, Afghanistan, a bit more subdued there, but that can erupt again. There's tensions between the Western powers and Russia over these things. And most of these issues can be traced back to that conflict 100 years ago. It's unfinished business, a lot of it, particularly what's going on in Palestine and Israel, but Syria as well, the Middle East, Iran, for example, once known as Persia, was subject of an Anglo-Russian carve-up before the First World War, another part of the deals that were being done by the big powers. And basically it amounted to, I think it was referred to by the British as, do I have it here? No, I don't. I've got it somewhere there. It was a big pile of papers, but I'll do the best I can from memory. It's referred to the British as a means for protecting the independence of Persia. And what essentially happened was that Russia was allowed to have the northern part, Britain had the southern part, and there was a bit in the middle that was to be like a buffer zone between the two, and that would be the independent Persia, I guess, according to that way of thinking. They did a similar thing, Britain and France, with Morocco. They issued a treaty, a document saying that neither country, neither Britain nor France, had any intention to change the status of Morocco. I mean, governments issue things like that, that's when you have to wonder what's going on. It's like when they had a peace conference in 1899 and none of the powers could agree, you know, what to do. That's when you know that there's probably going to be a war. I think we've said that quite often, that it's not until they start talking about peace that you say, oh, I didn't know it was threatened. But then you find out, yes, it's always threatened. Well, you've got capitalism. So other tensions that exist in the world, of course, I don't know if I already mentioned, but tensions between Japan and China, that's a wee thing that could erupt into something much bigger. The causes of war are still the same as they were 100 years ago. It's the competition amongst the nation states for markets, trade routes, sources of raw materials, strategic frontiers and territories, and exploitable wage slaves. That's what it's all about. It's competition to sell commodities to the same people in the same world market. It's the same now as it was in 1914, and it's quite sad to find ourselves 100 years later still having to place on record our abhorrence of the latest manifestation of the callous, sordid and filthy mercenary nature of the international capitalist class, and to have to state once again that in all these wars that are going on today as we speak, that there's no interest at stake justifying the shedding of a single drop of working class blood. And again, we are left, rather pathetically but as emphatically as we can, protesting against the brutal and bloody butchery that's going on with our fellow workers elsewhere, where even if you're not involved directly in the war, you're suffering the usual misery and austerity that capitalism always seems to have in store for us. So that's the lot of us facing the threats and the reality of these wars 100 years after the first so-called Great War, the not-so-great war, as we are calling it, because how could any war be great from the working class point of view? It's a great war in the sense of its hugeness, the enormity of it, that it affected the world. But as far as working class interests are concerned, we've stated before and we'll continue to state, so long as capitalism lasts, that there can be no interests justifying the shedding of a single drop of working class blood, and that the solution is, instead of seeing our interests as connected in some fashion with our so-called fellow countrymen who are our masters, to see that we have a common interest with workers throughout the world who slave in common with us to produce the wealth that our masters then quarrel over. And I think at that point, that basically sums up the socialist position on where we were then and where we are now.
Well, come, the floor is open now for discussion, if anybody would like to start off the discussion.
With Queen Mary, I don't know, is she German herself?
Yes.
But I mean, the thing about it is, when did they change her name to Windsor? Is it during the 18th war?
Yes. I think it was, yes, during that war.
It became politically
bad. What was her name, by the way?
Battenberg.
Battenberg.
Well, that was one of the names they used. They also used Saxe Coburg Gotha. That was one of the other ones.
The owning class normally have got more money, they've got more names.
You have to. Because it's not impressive if you've only got a couple of names.
I watch how you speak to Richard Dobson Donnelly then.
Yes.
Well, Teresa Ridley Ross, because I kept that bit because the bank, the parts department, the wages department were notorious. If you changed your address or changed anything, you screwed up your money for months, for instance. So when I married Bill, I just kept the two names.
Yes.
People in the bank are quite impressed by my double
double-barreled name. Yes, I was nearly going to refer to her as our compatriots, our fellow members of our own class referred to her as. In those days when they talked about her, they always seemed to say, Queen Mera! You know, that way they had of you know, enunciating
this. The thing that struck me about the talk governing or surrounding the First World War is that they've not moved on an inch. I would have expected that there would be some recognition of the causes of the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
But no, not a word. Even in the field of economics, there has been progress. Well, you've got economists, bourgeois economists, extolling Marx's theory of how the capitalist system works. But when it comes to the First World War, when I saw Cameron on television, it was a morning programme, and he gave the most crass explanation of the war. That it was all to do with little Belgium.
Uh-huh.
We couldn't stand by and see this British nation crushing this small nation. We had to step in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that really dismayed me. Does he actually believe that? I just hadn't
probably
expressed the words. The solutions that he wants to see. And then years ago, there was a pet economist who get wheeled out every now and again in the BBC whenever he needed an historian. H.I.P. Taylor.
Oh, yes.
H.I.P. Taylor. I mean, all these academics are trying to sort of get one over on all the others
and each other,
to come up with some sort of thing that's been so far missed. And here he is laying it bare. And he said it all had to do with the European railway system. But Germany and the Central Powers, and before the war, studied the European railway system and had been pleasantly surprised by its efficiency and the accuracy of its timetables, and that made them think, hey, we can use this in our battle against Britain and France and so on. And you know, nothing has changed. They're still trotting out the same absurd simplistic solutions as they always have done up to the present.
I think much of the reason is, in a lot of cases, they genuinely don't know because they're used to dealing with superficialities. But I think for members of the ruling class, they do know, because if you own things, you don't have to be that sophisticated and to know how to defend your interests. And this is a class that will say anything or pay other people to say anything to cover up their tracks. And it's interesting, in that programme, The Necessary War, Max Hastings' programme, he did have these, because I don't think he's actually a proper historian, although what is a proper historian anyway? He's really, I think of him as a journalist, but people have been calling him an historian recently, so I don't know. Anyway, he had some, what I suspect were perhaps, would be generally agreed to be real historians, on who he asked about some of the details to try and back up his case. And one of them was quite interesting. A guy called Sir Hugh Strachan, and he said, he was talking about both of the wars. He said, nobody went to war in 1939 to stop Germans massacring the Jews. In some respects, both wars break out for similar reasons. And then he went on to say, great powers' rivalries and balance of power in Europe, they are remarkably similar causation. But there was a bit where he mentioned, I thought he had mentioned economic rivalries, but great powers' rivalries and balance of power in Europe. There was a point, I'm sure, where he mentioned something to do with the economics of it, the material interests, and Max Hastings just ignored that bit. So when I said in the synopsis that our position, the true position, would actually be ignored or put forward as background, has turned out to be sadly, more correct than I thought it was. Although, I didn't expect to hear any mention of that. But the fact was, in amongst all the other verbiage, it was just lost. Max Hastings just ignored it when the other guy said this and just went on to say, well, anyway, I think Germany was still to blame because it could have apparently restrained Austria, which maybe it could. But then Max Hastings, starting from the point of view that it was only right and proper that Britannia ruled the waves and it was a damn cheek of any German upstarts to try and expand at England's expense. And that's the viewpoint that he's coming from, the viewpoint of a British capitalist class. Whether he fully realises it or not, in his case he may not, but certainly the people with real serious wealth, they'll say anything to defend that wealth. And they're quite cunning and they're taught in kind of code. That's why that statement, the police apparently framed some cabinet minister by saying he had referred to them as plebs. It rang true because that's how these people speak about the likes of us. So the police were a wee bit cleverer than usual, but it turns out the police were framing the guy, possibly. Doesn't matter to us, we don't care. In fact, it's a good thing to see members of the capitalist class or their representatives falling out with the police, their watchdogs. That can be quite amusing.
The Romans said, call them plebs, sardida, the great and most.
Yeah.
Great and most. But there was an economist, I can't remember his name, but he argued that the Germans were trying to build a pipeline from, this is a in and out, from Afghanistan. The oil would come through to Germany and the British didn't want that. They're talking about a pipeline similar to the one they're doing now in Afghanistan, and the British were
Oh, there's a lot of things that the British wouldn't have, because by that time the song Rule Britannia was a statement of fact and not just an exhortation, as the song had started out as, like when they were first building their empire. It was a matter of fact, much the way that America can just dominate the world today and sees fit to board anyone's ships if it suits their purpose.
See, that idea that, you know, do the owning class really know how their system operates and that? It's very strange if they didn't know how it is. They always seem to act in their own interests, you know, and that behind all these trade agreements and all that, there's crass economic reasons rather than moralistic ones, no matter how they dress it up. You know, it's no accident. So some of them know about it. I mean, maybe some are so bloody dumb that they actually believe their own bloody nonsense, you know. I mean, I think some politicians do.
Oh, yes, I think a lot of them do. And it's in the wider interest of the capitalist class to keep the thing obscure. And this is why they're quite happy to have historians. Apparently, one who said, I think I quoted it in the synopsis, she said that socialists, historians are still trying to unravel this 100 years later. Well, okay, maybe a lot of them are, but that's because they've got themselves into a mess over things that, I mean, they talk about disembodied forces a lot of the time, the forces of nationalism, forces of racism, forces of militarism. What are these? These are not disembodied forces. These are historic forces that exist as part of a society, and that society is divided into classes, and those classes have interests, and one class owns the state, controls the state. So, you know, that's what it's about. It's not disembodied forces that are just somehow floating about there and they all get out of control. You know, they represent someone's interests. A nation is not what they claim it is. In fact, they don't really seem to ever define it. They seem to assume that we all know and we all feel part of it. Well, I've never had it properly explained to me. Something's gone wrong with my...
You know, it's some workers taking part in the 1939-45 war on the position of saying, oh, that's it. So we'll beat our rivals. And then later on, maybe their sons, maybe them, but possibly their sons, would have to go to Germany for a job.
Right.
You know, remember that, off we does it.
That's right,
But there's my son-in-law, who's a really nice guy, Stephen, and he's a millionaire, and he has got absolutely no political, I would say, even sort of I mean, economics, he knows how to make money.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think on the whole sort of scheme of things, he thinks about economics in that sense. Mm-hmm. He only thinks about it, obviously, in the narrow sense.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I mean, there's a typical example. They're getting a couple of £1,000 for 2 days, and they're put up at a five-star hotel for 2 days because this is the second time. Well, you've got money. Because of your contacts, you always get more. This happens all the time. You know, he's had lots of things, like they go to big do's and they get everything for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hotels and here, there, and everywhere. They were at two because of the Commonwealth thingy bobbers, and they were at two big do's, big meals, and all the rest of it, and champagne and whatnot, all for nothing. Mm-hmm. Whereas ordinary punters, obviously, they don't get anything like that. You know what?
That's why Andy and I are going to do it inside.
The thing is, he doesn't have. I mean, he's making the money, politics. But he hasn't got the
a class perspective.
No,
he doesn't.
A lot of them don't.
A lot of them don't. That's what I mean. A lot of them don't need that. As long as they can make the money for themselves, they don't think they need to look at. Anything else?
Some even are contradictory. I mean, I did hear one a number of years ago who was a perfume manufacturer, so he's a fairly big capitalist, and he was a pacifist, and he was refusing to pay a certain portion of his taxes because he said that would go towards producing war materials and so on. So you do get some members of the capitalist class, but those who have inherited are quite close to the levers of power. The ones that actually
the
seriously large, you know, the people that know that they, you know, the ones that not the ones that necessarily go way back, but are fused with the people that go way back. You know, when the top levels of the aristocracy and the capitalist class found it useful to merge because some had money, others had position, and just the peculiar historic circumstances it suited their purpose, and they've kind of merged into obviously now the one. The capitalist class, and those people who are accustomed to wielding power, they know the situation, they know what they're doing. But there are many capitalists, like a lot of small business people who are technically capitalists and just want to do their own thing, don't want to know anything about politics.
I mean, I must say, he's really good to his staff. He's got 72 staff, like in different places and offices, and he's pretty good to them. They all say that and they all want to stay with him.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's because he came from a working class background that might be some reason why he's good to the people that work for him. But at the same time, he did say to me that when you're good to your staff, you get better results.
So well, of course, that does pay.
It's just not a kind act in a way, because there's always an agenda behind it, you know what I mean?
We'll see the politicians that are most credited, you know, we, you know, know which ones are going to. The politicians, you know, most credited with knowledge of the economy are, of course, chancellors, treasury ministers and so on. But what are they really doing? I mean, they're just reacting to, you know, the present circumstances are very much caught up in things like balance of payments, the rate of inflation, interest rates, public expenditure, trade deficits, you know, you can go on and on. But they're really just dealing with symptoms, aren't they? It's a bit like a doctor, you know, that is treating symptoms but doesn't understand the underlying cause. A doctor, you know, with a familiar knowledge of medicine, I think they've got a capitalism. I mean, think of all the chancellors you've had, you know, like going back to George Brown and Nigel Austin and Gordon Brown, Osborne and so on. I mean, I doubt very much if they've got to an understanding of the underlying forces, you know, which... bring all this to the surface, you know, the things which I mentioned, as I said, they're only reacting, and no sooner do they deal, you know, with one problem but another one arises, you know, it's like a dam, I suppose, you know, that keeps leaking water. Well, that's what I think anyway.
Do they deal with anything? Have they dealt with anything?
Well, at best in a very transitory way, you know.
But even capitalism is a fight between the so-called pacifists and the people are making missions. I mean, Harry Morrison wrote a fantastic article in the Western Socialist about the hawks and the doves. Mm-hmm. And they were saying that the students stopped the Vietnam War, and he's pointed to it, wasn't he? People like Pepsi Cola, Coca Cola, who were paying huge taxes for a war that got nothing out of. Mm-hmm. And the army munitions manufacturers, they were the hawks. They wanted a war because they were getting, mm-hmm. I mean, they're very expensive wars, they've got to pay heavy taxes, but they were getting money out of it. Whereas Pepsi Cola, and they were the real doves, no, the students, they enlisted their aid. Mm-hmm. And even they have economic interests, although they claim to be pacifists. Oh. They said, we want capital, we want these wars which cost a lot of money that we've got to pay heavy taxes for.
They expect to get something out of a war. I mean, that's always been, I mean, even before capitalism. The rulers of the country, the owners of the country, the landowners, they went to war to definitely get something. It just wasn't the same dynamic as it is in capitalism.
Also, the politicians, they had to start paying attention to public opinion. Otherwise, you know, they were in danger of losing elections. You know, Nixon, for instance, he did go to the country. He went to the American public, you know, promising to end the Vietnam War. He did, in fact, end up escalating, didn't he? But that was, I mean, there was a high, you know, a relatively high casualty rate amongst Americans. I think there was, well, I mean, it was massively great on the Vietnam side, but I think somewhere almost 60,000 American personnel were killed there. And, you know, it became massively unpopular. Also, many of the soldiers, you know, were, they weren't exactly fighting fit. I mean, towards the end, anyway, you know, they were heavily into narcotics, and you know, they weren't prosecuting the war in a sort of wholehearted way. But could any you know, comment on what I'm saying here about Treasury ministers, chancellors? I mean, how far does their knowledge? I mean, Ed Balls, for instance, he's credited with having, you know, very profound knowledge of economics, but how bloody profound is this, or rather how superficial is it?
They're
really reacting to events, at least that's what I think. They don't even understand, you know, the complex intricacies of capitalism. Well, what would you say about this?
Well, he wasn't Jeffrey was Margaret Thatcher's first Chancellor of Exchequer, and he made his speech. He says, even Marx was a monetarist. They were using Milton Friedman, and that's what opposed. He was explaining cause and effect. He was a monetarist, but even he said, even Karl Marx was a monetarist.
No, even a Keynesian, no.
Like you mentioned, George Brown, I think he was pessimist at the time.
Although they often said they described it as overwrought in those days, but then somebody says, "I as overwrought as a newt."
Well, actually, Harold Wilson said he didn't drink any more than me, just couldn't hold it as well. Well, you don't drink more than Harold Wilson.
Apparently, Harold Wilson smoked cigars.
Uh-huh,
he was
right.
Never ever seen me one.
No.
Because he thought that made him too posh. I saw a pipe, but it made him look too posh. You know?
Right. Even the politicians like Nixon was one of the most anti-red communist politicians ever. He was the first American president to visit China.
Uh-huh.
Because, as a standard pointed out way back then, you've got 600 billion potential commodity buyers.
Exactly.
And recognise that as important, you know.
And now you hear American economists saying, it's not so much Chinese communism that we fear as Chinese capitalism. You know, they've actually said that.
They don't disguise anymore the fact that you get billionaires and millionaires there, even though they still call it communism.
I know, it's a really curious thing where you've got this communist party.
Shanghai's full of really rich.
London's filling them as well, isn't it? They're all buying them. Yeah. £1 million properties and
all. Well, a lot of former Bolsheviks are now Russian capitalists.
Maybe
the oligarchs, as they call them.
They're talking about the First World War. It was that Churchill turned around and says that Jellicoe was the only man that could have won it. They could have lost the war in an afternoon, the Battle of Jutland, you know. Mm-hmm. He was in charge of the fleet, wasn't he? But it could have been a bigger fleet if they thought the Germans could beat them in an afternoon.
No,
the German
Navy was chased in the First World War anyway, although there was a disastrous battle. Nonetheless, German fleet was chased back in and never came back out again.
They
were never. The only ones that managed to get out were the U-boats, because they were a relative novelty then.
They weren't very efficient at that time either.
No.
They were pretty Not really. I'm not creative, but I mean, I don't get that.
Worked out, Conrad. Time's getting on.